Welcome to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Every week, you'll find us right here as we follow the stories that affect the land and communities of the peninsula. This week, join us for a trip to Colchester Farm in Kent County to speak with Rob Etkin. Rob is manager of the farm as well as being the director of the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy. We'll discuss the connection between farming and preserving land and much more. Then in the second half of the show, we travel to Cottingham Farm in Talbot County. There we speak with Cleo Braver. She's the farm's proprietor, who's not just busy farming, but also rethinking our entire approach to agriculture. First, let's get you home safe and turn this over to WEAA traffic. And then we'll be headed right back to Colchester Farm with Rob Etkin. Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Here's our interview with farmer and conservationist Rob Etkin. Talk about Colchester Farm. What is this place?
Yeah, Colchester Farm is, it's been in the Woodall family off and on, which the Woodalls is one of those families deep rooted in the shore that's been here since the late 1600s, and everybody's related somehow to a Woodall in Kent County. It's pretty shocking who you run across that's related to them. But the owner of the farm, Charlotte Stalen, who is a Woodall, and she... this farm, I guess her mom was the owner for a long time. She got it about 21 or 22 years ago from her mom. So it was always in the family, but directly hers about 22 years ago. And she, actually her mom worked with Eastern Shore Land Conservancy to put it under preservation.
Which you are the president of, right?
Right, executive director of the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy. So we've been, I knew her mom pretty well, and then Charlotte came back from a long circuitous route around the globe with her teaching, and she came back and settled on the farm about 21, 22 years ago and wanted to sort of make a go of this place. And so I've come in only in the last 5 or 6 years, and so she's in Chestertown, and my wife and I and daughters are in this house. So Colchester Farm itself is a 357-acre farm. It's got a whole variety of different things going on it. We have about 180 acres of traditional cash grain, soybeans, corn, wheat, barley, kind of a rotation. And we work with a farmer who has farmed or lived on this land for 75 years. The farmer actually lived on it for 50 years, and he's been farming it for 75 years, so lots of history.
He has been farming for 75 years?
Yeah, well, he and his dad, actually. Now his son and grandson are actually joined in, too. So there's a long lineage with that farm family. Over time, over the last 20 years, actually over the last 6 years, 7 years, a variety of different things have blossomed here under the under a vision that Charlotte had for a Colchester Institute. She always claims it was sort of, you know, around bottles of wine with her kids in the 70s that, you know, they always wanted to make an institute here because I think that was the thing to do at the time, you know, to solve world peace and, you know, well, let's have an institute. So they wanted to have a Colchester Institute. Some of the legs of that stool were local food production. So this goes way back. Some sort of spiritual retreat kind of function. And, you know, we can talk more about that. And then there's also environmental stewardship. So they wanted to create this thing. So the vision was sort of out there for 2 decades, let's say. And not much happened until 6 years ago. Charlotte helped get started with myself and folks from the American Farmland Trust and some others, CSA. So if you're not familiar with CSAs, it's community-supported agriculture. So we have about 10 acres in vegetables over on this part of the farm. That there's 55 different varieties of vegetables grown, 14 different varieties of tomatoes. I mean, you get the picture. And those vegetables are all sold to or shared with 150 families through the CSA model. So every week, those 150 families essentially pay for their vegetables at the beginning of the season, and then for 26 weeks they get a big box of vegetables of whatever's ripe that week. And so every Friday afternoon, you know, this place is swarming with 150 families or so. Not quite that many because some pick up off site, but lots of people picking up lots of food. So if you can think about what either a half a bushel of vegetables basically every Friday for 150 families, it's a lot of food going here, especially when it's like watermelon or cantaloupe time. You know, there's truckloads of this stuff. So there's lots and lots of vegetables and lots of interest in the CSA concept. There's usually a waiting list for the CSA every year, and it really is a great way to bring people closer to where their food's produced, and they can get to know their farmer and see where the food's from, and it's all pesticide free. And nothing inorganic goes on. They're not certified organic, but nothing inorganic goes on the vegetables here. So it's been a great concept. That's a real steady part of Colchester. We also have sort of my little baby is about 50 acres in that part of the farm that we're transitioning to organic. And that is right now we have to make decisions for starting next spring, but the idea is on the table. We want to have a little bit of organic grain so Andy can participate. Andy, the farmer of the grain, so he's never tried organic, so we feel it's important to help Andy try this out as, you know, not as a representative of other agriculture, but you know, he's big time agriculture on the Eastern Shore. He grows lots of beans and corn for the chicken industry, and just to try it in the context of organic, we feel it's important to have him come along with us. So he farms 14 other farms in the area. So it'll have some grain on it. We're also looking at grass-fed beef, pastured poultry, which we have a history of here.
You have some now.
Yeah, well, they're all in the freezer or in other people's tummies right now because it's the end of the season, but we do them seasonally. Uh-huh. And we have an eggmobile operation, so a small egg operation. And the other things for the organic ground, we'll probably do some organic hay. And Charlotte wants to do organic wine grapes. And that, you know, the efficacy of that, it remains to be seen. So we're going to have to look much, much more deeply at that. Just because the Eastern Shore, nobody's done organic grapes over here. Everybody's doing grapes now, but nobody's done organic grapes. And the feeling is it's pretty humid over here. Compared to California, it's easy to do organic because it's so dry, but here it's pretty humid and we have a lot more fungal diseases and spots and things like that.
So is it hard when you want to plan organic to worry about that part of it, to farm in an area like this organically? Is that the same issue if you're growing corn, tomatoes, squash?
No, everything's different. Like in the CSA, that we have a CSA manager, and she does not want to go organic because she can't get, so her specialty is specialty garlics. There's half a dozen different kinds of garlic she grows. She's very good at it, and she's also great with these tomatoes, all kinds of different heirloom tomatoes, but you just can't get the seeds for those kind of unique crops organically. It's just I guess the existence of the marketplace hasn't developed, you know, fully yet. You can make them, you know, you can develop organic seed stock for all those varieties. It just hasn't been done. It's just not available. So she'd have to grow her own seed, and, you know, it's just for it to be certified organic to do the way she would like to. So it's sort of problematic there.
So it's like a political chart. They said leans Democratic, leans Republican. That garden would kind of lean organic.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, it's organic practices, but she just doesn't use organic seed. So it can't be certified organic. But some, you know, I think organic remains to be seen here on the shore. It's being accepted pretty widely because the consumer markets are there. And, you know, even guys that grow organic soybeans, you can sell them through a shop in Pennsylvania, and there's a huge premium on organic soybeans and corn that are used for organic feed it would be certified organic feed, so you can grow organic chickens and organic beef. So, you know, it is feed, but it's for the organic meat industry, and it's just a huge premium on the price of that stuff. So you can make some money with it. So, but it's it cuts both ways. You know, I think on a lot of people are looking at organic as the savior for the bay. And if you talk, or at least what I've learned, it's much more mixed up story than that, because with organic you can't use herbicides. So much of the Eastern Shore has been in no-till, so we don't really till the ground in a significant proportion. This is not everywhere, but in a significant proportion, you know, farmers over here are using no-till practices, which are great for erosion. They just, you don't turn the dirt over, you just knife in the seed and the fertilizer, and so the surface stays intact and the plants grow up through. But with organic, but to do no-till, you have to be able to control weeds with chemicals. So in organic, you can't use chemicals, so you have to till. And so if you till the field, like we had to till this field here to start the organic transition, and then we had a 4-inch rain the next day, and it's it, you know, there is sedimentation comes off of organic ground much more so than off of no-till inorganic sort of growing method. So it's mixed. I mean, there's less pesticides, but there's more sediment, I think, coming off of organic. That's a generalization, but not, it's not across the board, because if certainly if we had it in hay or something, it would have been fine. But it's just, it's not quite, if the whole Eastern Shore was organic, that wouldn't necessarily be a great thing for the bay. It probably would, it would change the dynamics. There'd be less toxins, but there would be more sediment and probably more phosphorus in there. Maybe less nitrogen, although probably not, because these organic grounds still use fertilizer. They just use organic fertilizer and not chemical fertilizer.
Which you have to have buffers, right?
Yeah, you have to have buffers. Yeah, no question. And we have big buffers here, but, you know, they don't do the whole job.
There's no way to grow food and not have something go into the water.
I don't know. I wouldn't say no way. You know, there's some people in, I guess, the Land Institute in Kansas. I don't know if you've heard about them, but there are people doing experiments around that with growing food that have zero or almost zero impacts on the environment. And like the place in Kansas, the Land Institute, is really pioneering perennials. So instead of, like, if you're growing, let's say, soybeans, they're trying to come up with perennial varieties. So you never all you have to do is go out there and harvest. You don't have to go back and till the soil and plant the next year or control weeds. The beans just come up again. So instead of, most of our crops are an annual. So you go out and plant them every year, harvest it in the fall, plant it again, harvest it. But a perennial, like, you know, some of our perennial flowers that just, like bulbs, like tulips and jonquils, you know, they just come up every year. So that's the concept. So they're trying to figure out if they can develop seed sources for major crops that are perennial. And if you think about it, you know, that would really be great for the bay, because you would be no soil disturbance. The inputs would be natural, especially if you can use nitrogen fixers that get the nitrogen out of the air. So it's a lot of potential there, and there's other things around too. So I wouldn't say there's no way to grow food without an impact, but it's all sort of common sense, and minimizing impact on the bay, I think, is the goal. I don't know that getting to zero, even forests, you know, which are the preferred land use, still have a fairly significant amount of nutrients coming out of a forest, you know, nitrogen particularly, that goes into the bay. It's just, you know, it's much less than agriculture. It's much less than a sewage or a septic tank, right, like from to serve houses. So it's all relative. Just want to do as good a job as we can and keep improving.
So when you look at the different parts of your farm here, and this is actually an interesting thing to think about with this farm being such an old farm.
Yes.
On the Eastern Shore. And you have a family of farmers generations old who are farming a good piece of land. And you have your organic and CSA farm on the other side here.
Right.
So what is there in your mind a way to marry those two? Does that exist, or are they... is it a contradictory and things just have to change in ways we're not thinking about it?
Mark, I think you're getting right at the soul of, I think, where Eastern Shore agriculture is. And you think, you know, those things are wide apart. Well, we do, I lead meditation here, you know, we do meditation retreats. So that's sort of even, that looks wild to the people that come from the organic side. So there's all kinds of wild stuff here. But I'm impressed with families like the Chances that, you know, I would say the agricultural personality farmers aren't early innovators. They're not big risk takers. They're more cautious, and you know, the wisdom of farming is handed down from generation to generation. So it's a culture that is more anchored in longevity than doesn't adjust very quickly to changes in society. I think by nature farmers are that way. But I've been very impressed with the Chances that, you know, when we asked them about organic, they were like, well, yeah, I think we'll try it with you. You know, we're all trying it together, which I think is a great step. And, you know, and I know other traditional farmers, when I say that, I mean sort of corn and beans and grain, small grain farmers, have been trying different things as well. And a lot of times, you know, you'll hear them talk about, well, you know, this is really maybe not what my father did, but what my grandfather did was very similar to these practices. So it's not too foreign. That's a roundabout way to say I'm optimistic that all of these different kinds of agriculture can coexist here on the shore, and they are very successfully. And I think with the new things like pastured poultry or organic or grass-fed beef, the more those new initiatives make money, I think the more, you know, traditional will shift over and take advantage of those markets. Because if you think about Delmarva, I mean, we do this poultry industry is such a great thing for the farm economy because they use so many soybeans and corn right there in the Salisbury area. There's a huge premium over on our grains, our traditional grains, over what if we had to sell them through the Chicago Board of Trade to other markets in the U.S. and around the world. It's a much lower price, plus there's transport costs. But the fact that the people can sell them there, right there in Salisbury, is a premium, and it's been great for the farmers here. So it's it's been economically, it's been a good thing. But we do need to we're within a 4-hour drive of a third of the nation's food consumers, and so I guess that includes Philadelphia to Norfolk, so maybe it includes Boston. That'd be on the bubble. I've heard 4, but actually if I drove it, it'd probably be 5 to 6 to get to Boston.
Boston's about 6 hours from here. New York's about 3.
Yeah.
3.5, 4.
So either way, right in that window, which is an easy drive for fresh produce, you can get to about a third of the nation's food consumers. So we are the largest contiguous block of prime farmland on the East Coast.
Some of the prickly issues before we come back to the farm.
Yeah.
Your farm here, Cultures, I'm really interested in this place. But that you talked about poultry. Mm-hmm. Now, the power of big chicken is huge in Delmarva.
Right.
Really. So there's a lot of argument about that. I mean, could the agricultural economy, do you think, survive in Delmarva in alternative ways other than industrial chicken, for want of a better term? I mean, can you, you know, right now we grow our chickens in these hundreds of thousands of chickens in teeny little areas, and, you know, and, yeah. and there's all issues of
right.
the debate over pollution in the water and
right.
the role that plays, but also just even the health of the chicken, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I mean, is there a way that agriculture can survive without that?
I would say no in the short term, maybe on the long term. So if I guess the specter that's out there is, gosh, what if we push Delmarva poultry off of Delmarva through regulation or whatever, or, you know, transportation problems or whatever it is, what would happen to the shore? We get that question often. And I think the overwhelming dominant overwhelmingly dominant land use here and within agriculture is for corn, beans, grain, other small grains that are used for the poultry industry. So if they went away, we'd have 90% of our agricultural land, the primary market for it would be gone. So there's no way we could transition in a quick way to that. And if you look at, like, we have 150 families being fed out of 10 acres here on this CSA, and the amount of food we can produce with 50 acres of organic is extraordinary as well. So when you, but the rest of this farm, when you talk about, there's another 180 acres here that's just in the cash grain. So if the market for all of that went away, there's no way we, there's not enough labor, there's not enough market demand to use all of that up with these much more, all of these new niche kind of foods are much more intensive in the amount of space they use up. So we would have a surplus of land. So what would happen from that is anybody's guess. Obviously, land prices would go way down. Some would revert to forest, which might be good for the bay. But the other thing that likely would be would happen is the pressure for sprawl would go way up. So we might get, I don't know where the housing and mortgage industry is going, but it would be much cheaper to build houses on all the farmland. And I think from the bay's perspective, that would be a big negative. That would be much worse than agriculture if we started to spread out more with our housing. So it's an open question, but if poultry went away, it you know, eventually we'd figure something out, but it would take a long time, and the economic sort of ramifications of that on the shore would be tremendous. There would be wholesale farmers going bankrupt and leaving the farm, and all of that kind of stuff would happen during the transition period. There's no question. And I think other things would start to pick up. We'd start to figure out things like, there's some things on the horizon like switchgrass, which is very bay friendly, and there a lot of folks are pushing that as a biofuel, and we're developing, we're not getting there very fast, but we're developing ways to burn switchgrass that, you know.
There's a guy in the lower shore who's doing that, isn't there? He's running his furnace or boiler or someplace on the switchgrass that grow on two men. I think one of them's like a Dorchester County commissioner or whatever.
No, there's one in, I don't know who you're talking about. Y Research Center, University of Maryland Research Center, has a switchgrass burner. That's where our office is. And they grow switchgrass and burn it there and provide a portion of the heat that they use and energy. So there's, it looks like the numbers work for switchgrass, and switchgrass is a very, very bay-friendly planting because it's dense and it's perennial. So you put it in, every year it comes up this high, has a great mat for capturing runoff, and it's deep-rooted, so it does pull nutrients up out of the groundwater as well. So it really is a terrific crop for the bay, and to find an economic use for it is tremendous, but to think if we lost poultry and all of this grain land was out there, you know, I don't know. I wish I had the statistics. What could we do with all that switchgrass? Let's say we shifted it all to switchgrass. It'd be great for the bay, but you wouldn't, you just wouldn't have a market that quickly. We'd have to turn around our whole energy system here on Delmarva to use it up.
So the idea that a farmer surviving, I had a discussion with some other people this a few couple of weeks ago, the whole idea of what it takes for a farmer to survive. I mean, and to grow the food that we need to eat, could they survive in ways that were not massive chicken farms? And you're saying it would be very difficult to transition. It would be difficult to do that.
Yes. Yeah, no question. At a scale, you know, at the scale of Delmarva, just because we're a big contiguous area of farmland. So, you know, you can do it like economically. You know, if each family did something like the CSA, if you are willing to do that, you know, it's a lot of hard work out there. So it's a very labor intensive endeavor to do vegetables, particularly in that CSA model, because there's a lot of face to face with your, you know, all of the families want to bring their kids and they want to tug on the farmer's overalls and, you know, have the full experience. So it's very labor intensive. But more could do that, but it would only use up a small portion of the land over here. So we would have sort of this vulnerability of a lot of land being available with very little economic value to it. And so the potential is there to do something worse, like housing. You know, all over it.
Which is part of your other world.
Yeah, it's part of my day job.
Which is to worry about, think about sprawl and how towns develop without eating up the countryside and developing too much.
Right, right. Yes, I work for the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy, and we've been around for 20 years working with farmers and families to preserve their land. We've preserved 252 farms now on 48,000 acres, roughly. But we also have a lot of planning and regional policy development and advocacy, working on the agricultural issues and where do we go in the future, and as well as transportation and other, and town planning, community planning, parks, recreation, health of the bay, all of that stuff. So it is, so this farm is actually a little bit of an experiment for Eastern Shore Land Conservancy too, because Charlotte is leaving this farm hopefully many decades from now, but it's in her will to come to the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy. So we're using it as a experiment to learn about agronomics and producing local food and building community. So all of that is important to the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy.
So when people argue that some people argue that you could change the nature of agriculture in the Eastern Shore so that it could be primarily farms that, whether it's vegetables or grains or chickens or free-range beef or whatever it is, that could feed the shore and a good piece of America, and if we change how it's processed and where those plants are and how you do it, since it takes so much to get something to a plant,
right,
that they're not controlled by some large conglomerate, that could change, and nature of agriculture should change, and we could feed America. Is that just wishful thinking? Is that a mythology? Is that, from your perspective, working between both worlds?
No, I don't think it is. I mean, in some ways, we're doing that now, even though a significant, the overwhelmingly dominant by value and by sort of calorie production from the Eastern Shore is chicken. So we're just doing it through chicken now. Your vision is a much more diverse and providing direct food, vegetables, and a variety of other types of protein is sort of what your vision is. And I think we can get there, and I think it's important that we do get there. If you think about the Central Valley of California, it's I've heard that that one valley in California, which has gone through a transition like the one you suggest, is producing something like a third of the nation's fresh produce there. It's tremendous. You know, most of the stuff in our supermarkets either comes from Florida or the Central Valley of California.
Where I buy my organic strawberries from.
Right.
It's all coming from California.
Right, right. So, and Delmarva's not too dissimilar. That's a very fertile valley. They have water problems over there. We have much more water than they do. We have much more productive soils than they do. They just got way out front on building the infrastructure for those that type of agriculture. So but it's very intense. It's not necessarily easier on the land or on the bay, but it is. I think that potential exists for Delmarva because we are right here. We're isolated enough where we still have a chance to protect large blocks of farmland, but we're so accessible to these major eastern markets, really accessible to them, shockingly accessible to them. So I think we could get there, but I would prefer if we got there very carefully so that it's just like the scientists that look at bay pollution, you know. A good friend of mine is always fond of saying, you know, gosh, if you turned, 100-acre field into all vegetables for like giant food, which is not uncommon, there's some of those around, the nutrients it takes to do that are very, very significant. And you can do it carefully, but it's much easier to do a nutrient, a bay-friendly agricultural operation of 100 acres of grain than it is to do 100 acres of very intensive vegetables, because those vegetables need water, you know, on them all the time. So you've got to pull water up from the groundwater. They all need lots of fertilizer, and whether it's, you know, organic or inorganic, they need, you know, it takes a lot to stimulate those big, beautiful vegetables out of the ground. So it's very intense. So it's not necessarily an either or. Grain is bad and vegetables are good. There's more food production for people out of the vegetables than the grain, because the grain goes through the meat market. But it's much more complicated calculus.
So in political terms, again, for a minute, I mean, in some ways, you can do things on the Eastern Shore or the Central Valley of California or wherever you're going to do them.
Right.
But a lot of it, in just a pure political sense, has to do with that every, what is it, 5 years, agricultural bill that is debated in Congress, and where the subsidies go and what kind of agriculture we push in America. That has a lot to do with what could happen in the Eastern Shore or anywhere else. That has a huge factor in all that.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah, I took a sabbatical when the last farm bill was getting put together. No, actually, the farm bill was just passed, and there was something put in there for Delmarva. So I went to work for Congressman Gilchrist on this farm bill program, and then we were just fleshing it out and with the USDA. And I can tell you that the politics of the farm bill was just an eye-opening experience. I'm a pretty old guy, you know, and I've been around the block, but to go in there and see just the extraordinary pushes and pulls within Congress on that farm bill, you know, and these are big tectonic kind of pushes, like the Midwest against the niche farmers of the Northeast, and you know, so it's a very, very difficult dynamic to wrap your arms around and think you can sort of shake it up. So the changes to the farm bill politics happen slow and incrementally. So the next farm, you know, something gets in this time, just in language but without any appropriation, might get, you know, a little bit 7 years later at the next farm bill, might make another step. And that's what I've seen happen with conservation, the conservation titles within the farm bill. It's still a tiny, tiny piece of the farm bill goes to conservation. We would like to see it be a much bigger piece, but it's
that's a battle.
Yeah, it's a huge battle, and just making that more progressive over time is just slow. You know, it's just pushing molasses uphill. It's just there's big constituencies have grown up around the existing farm bill, and you know, those things don't change quickly.
That was Rob Etkin, manager of Colchester Farm in Kent County, Maryland, and director of the Eastern Shoreland Conservancy. We're going to take a very short break, and then we're coming right back with another Maryland farmer, Cleo Braver, from Cottingham Farm in Talbot County. You're listening to On Delmarva on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and we'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Up next, you'll hear from Cleo Braver, who owns Cottingham Farms in Easton. She's an environmental lawyer turned farmer who has a vision for how the entire food system in the state of Maryland should be reformed. I started by asking her to describe her farm.
It's like a 156-acre farm. It's actually the quintessential Maryland farm where it used to be, as far as averages go, for the average size farm, the average size of actual fields. You know, we had three fields that totaled 90 acres that were in the traditional feed corn, feed soy rotation, and I use that word loosely. And just out of my environmental work, you know, I was an environmental lawyer for 20 years.
Who'd you work for?
I was general counsel for a public company called Environmental Elements Corporation.
So you're here on the Eastern Shore. You found yourself here. You came here.
I found myself here, and I realized, you know, I think it's when I realized that as you're taking a drink and strolling along the banks in the evening and you see the fish jumping, I used to think, oh, how lovely, the fish are frolicking and feeding. And I don't know where I learned this, but that they're really, what they're doing is aerating the water so they can survive from dusk to dawn when the dissolved oxygen levels are the lowest. And I guess once you know that, it's hard to sleep at night. Mm-hmm. So environmental issues have sort of always driven me, and I just became, you know, curious about what it was and, you know, what was contributing to it. And I really came to focus from a lot of different analysis and talking to other folks that and looking at the scientists, which I think it's really what you have to look at is the scientific information, because we can all argue till the cows come home. But I think you got to look at the science. And the science, at least independent scientists, were saying that a significant portion of the pollution in the bay, nitrogen, the phosphorus, the sediment, it's coming from agriculture. And while agriculture has done an awful lot, there remains a lot to be done, in part because this is tenant farming systems here.
Tenant farming?
It's tenant farming. So the farmers will implement these good environmental practices on their own home farms, but they're not implemented on the farms that they farm for others. And that's about 65, maybe even as high as 80% of the farmland. So, you know, cover crops are not routinely put on. You know, buffer strips, that's the real big one. There's no buffer strips. I mean, they farm right up to the edge of the ditches. And that's just a system that's made to carry the excess nitrogen, the excess phosphorus, and the sediment. 5 tons an acre of sediment, 10 pounds an acre of phosphorus, and 100 pounds of nitrogen and then phosphorus. It's just, the system is made to pollute the bay. It's designed to pollute the
Not
bay.
Not consciously designed, you don't think? Fact of how it...
You know, they want water to run off the land. They don't want it to sit and get wet. They want to preserve their crops. But the fact is, you know, you look at the science coming out of Horn Point and other places. If you plug in efficacy of buffer to absorb nutrients, enter, you'll get hundreds of studies. You'll get scores of compendia of studies from around the world that say you need a minimum of 65-foot buffer. You know, the nitrogen goes down, so you really need the cover crops.
Not
farm and water. There's another huge fallacy. Between the edge of every farm field and the rest of the land. Because, you know, we're all in the watershed, whether you live on the water or not. I mean, it's all in the watershed. So it's really every farm field edge has to be buffered. And there are zoning requirements in place that I think for the most part, you know, aren't enforced at all. And there should be, you know, there should be buffers in place because it does yeoman's work and it protects us. It protects us all, and the farmers should be compensated. And they are. There are compensation programs that CREP, CRP, that compensates, but the compensation goes to the land owner and the farmer if he suggested to the landowner, gee, why don't we put in some buffer strips? We'll share the proceeds and we'll be the same. We'll get just as much money as we would growing corn. The farmers are afraid to have those conversations with the owners.
What's the delineation you just made between farmer and owner?
Well, like for instance, this farm, you know, we had an operator who comes in and they farm your. You know, we don't have the farm equipment to do the big fields, and so it's a farmer who, let's say, you know, a guy who farms 2,000 acres, he'll farm 300 or 500 on his home farm that he owns, right. And the other 1,500 right. will be farmed on land owned by others. And the structure is set up so that the CREP payments go to the owner, and the owner doesn't know about the CREP. And I'm sure if owners knew about these programs and understood them fully, they would have a conversation with their farmer and say, let's implement them. I'll share the proceeds with you. And it's a wash. You don't make any less money. You know, the federal programs as implemented by the states exist, but they're just not implemented in any meaningful way in the state of Maryland because of the tenant farming structure.
Well, I mean, I just want to get this clear in some terms. I mean, because most farmers I know farm the way you described, is that they have the land, but they also rent land from other people around to do their work. I mean, that wherever we are in Maryland, that's how people farm. People farm like that all over the country. But that's different than tenant farming, which is when you're actually literally working for somebody else and...
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm using the wrong term, but the notion is that most of the operators who actually do farm with the big equipment, they do a small percentage on their own land, and the rest is on land that they engage in one of a couple different relationships with the owner.
Right.
But the end result is, you know, whether they're bearing the risk and paying a certain, you know, fee to the owner of the land, or it's cost share where they share the cost, they share the revenue, the end result is still the same. The programs are set up, the federal programs are set up so that the owner gets the payment the farmer is kind of reluctant to have a conversation with the owner because they're legitimately, you know, concerned that if they told the owner about the programs, the owner would go, let's carve those 100-foot buffers out of all of our fields. And it takes up a lot of space, let me tell you. I mean, in our 90 acres, it was like 25 acres to have a 100-foot buffer. So it takes up a lot of the acreage. And, you know, you don't want to have the farmers have less to farm. And so they're reluctant to approach owners, tell them about the program, so they have the conversation and then share it. But I think owners, for the most part, if they understood what great work it would be for the Bay, what a great help it would be to the Bay, they would say, hey, I didn't know about that. Let's do that together, and let me share the proceeds with you. And I can only go on my own experience as an owner. I mean, look, I was an environmental lawyer. My husband's in environmental businesses. You know, we didn't really understand that those programs existed until I started kind of like scratching the surface, you know. And our farmer operator, you know, didn't volunteer the information. And you can understand why they'd be reluctant to do so.
Because they lose money.
Because they would assume that an owner being driven by profit is going to go, thanks for that information. Let's carve out 30 acres of our 90 acres. We're going to put CREP buffers in, and we're going to get all the proceeds, and you'll have less acreage to farm. And you may not even be coming down the lane anymore because it's got less acreage and it becomes more and more fragmented. And you know, you end up having all the development pressure. But so there's a program that exists that's not being taken advantage of in a meaningful way in the state of Maryland. That's problem one. But the bigger problem, I think, is that, you know, the agriculture that exists here is feed corn, which goes to feed CAFO chickens, which aren't meant to eat corn. And so they need to give them antibiotics, daily non-therapeutic doses of antibiotics to survive. What is it now? 39 days, one farmer was saying at a public meeting, it takes 39 days to grow a chicken to harvest. And they need antibiotics to survive the environments that they live in and the foods that they're fed. And so it's creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria like MRSA. Look at the work that Dr. Alan Silbergill is doing at Johns Hopkins. You know, that's an issue of concern. So you've got feed corn, which has high nitrogen requirements, which there's some studies that indicate, you know, that you know, up to 60% of the nitrogen doesn't actually get taken up by the corn. It ends up into the Chesapeake Bay if you don't have cover crops on. The phosphorus, if you don't have, you know, CREP buffers. And so then it goes to feed the CAFO chickens, and then the CAFO chickens go, you know, to feed chicken McNuggets. And
the system you're talking about was created historically by business to feed masses of people in America inexpensively because people couldn't afford food.
But cheap food has a high price. And the high price is all those externalized costs. And the externalized costs that are not reflected in the cost of the food, you know, is the environmental costs of nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment going into the Chesapeake Bay and killing the bays and killing the Gulf of Mexico and hypoxia and dead zones. And it's the healthcare costs. Because we're eating, you know, food that's not good for us. I mean, we're eating corn syrup, basically. We're corn walking, as they say, in the wonderful spate of, you know, new movie releases, Food Inc. And you know, it's a problem. And our healthcare costs are tremendous. The Centers for Disease Control estimates it's like 50% of our healthcare costs are totally avoidable. By things like, you know, our diet, failure to exercise, and other volitional acts like smoking. But it can have a tremendous impact on the healthcare costs of this country. This new kind of agriculture that's emerging in pockets, you know, creates jobs too. I mean, you know, some of the really intense agriculture like this, like greenhouse agriculture, can create, you know, 4, 5, 6 jobs an acre. So it can create jobs. We can create a system where Marylanders are paying Marylanders to grow food, rather than Floridians and Californians and Mexicans and Canadians. It can help provide, you know, land to implement environmental practices because it's labor-intensive food production, not land-intensive. So the land can be freed up to do these environmental practices. There's a lot of bennies. There's multiple benefits by converting to the old way of eating. I mean, just look at the miles traveled, you know, of food in this country. I mean, it's a significant part of our energy costs.
The farmer you talked about who rents land from you or anybody else has to make a living. And that when they put buffers in, it saves the bay. And when he can't grow his mass feed corn for the chicken industry, then the farmer says, in many ways, maybe quite rightly, how am I going to survive? I can't make a living if I do these things immediately. What do I do?
Well, I think that there'll be some farmers who will convert, just like the tobacco farmers, you know, with the help of the state, converted to growing wine grapes. You know, I think I'm not saying that they should be doing this on their own. It's a system that, frankly, was put into place because the subsidies were created to incentivize farmers to grow so much feed corn. I mean, we wouldn't have these huge amounts of feed corn and feed soy unless they're being paid tremendous federal subsidies to do so. I mean, some of the larger farmers, you know, get over $1 million a year to grow feed corn and feed soy. And, you know, they're not doing what they're doing because they want to poison the Chesapeake Bay and create obesity. I mean, they're doing it because society said to them, hey, do this. This is so important. We'll pay you to do it. If you look at, like, for instance, if you look at the USDA charts of mm-hmm. the different states of, you know, what a different states produce, you know, we're number 4 in broiler production. We're number, I don't know, 4 to 7 in feed corn. You look at dairy, you know, you look at beef cattle, you look at vegetables, fruits, nuts, you know, we're Zippo, we're zippity-doo-dah. You know, there's a whole agricultural vibrant economy that can be created.
This used to be Dairyland.
Used to be dairies, used to be peaches, used to be wheat, you know, wheat in George Washington's time to feed the troops. I mean, you know, just because it's been corn for 45 years doesn't mean it always has to be. You know, some farmers won't convert. Some will. Some will convert some of their land, not maybe not all of it, but it can be, you know, the new vision, I think, the alternative vision is to say we're actually growing food for people rather than food for animals. It takes much less land to do so, less freeing up land for environmental practices, creates a lot of jobs, hopefully would have this impact in a fairly short term on healthcare costs. And they've got to be helped to do it. I mean, I agree. We've led them down this path, and there needs to be we need to really convert some of the subsidies that are in the farm bill from corn to more sustainable, more diverse, sustainable agriculture that's not monoculture.
You're listening to our conversation with Cleo Braver, owner of Cottingham Farm in Easton. We decided to take a walk outside to look at a few of her fields. I asked her about the challenge facing large institutions that want to purchase food in a more sustainable way.
There's so many hospitals like Maryland Hospitals for Healthy Environment, Louise Mitchell.
Yeah.
They're all looking at, like, you know, redoing their contracts with the food suppliers, you know, having 10% be local, 10% be, you know, pesticide free. Prisons, I've had prisons that are interested in buying, you know, food. I mean, large institutions really are trying to affect change. But we need to grow more farmers to grow this food. And one of the other impediments is a lot of schools and hospitals now no longer actually have kitchens to make food. They really just set up now to reheat the ARA or, you know, the Cisco. And so there's other limitations. I mean, the system's gotten so ingrained that an awful lot has to kind of be changed before it can be implemented.
So talk about this place, okay. Your place. Your Covington Farm, is it?
It's Cottingham Farm.
Cottingham Farm.
It turns out that it's been called this since 1662. The Jonathan and William Shaw brothers from their estate Cottingham in Yorkshire, England, got a 900-acre land grant from the then Lord Baltimore. So as I say, it's 3 fields, and they were feed corn, and one of the fields has very wet soils, hydric soils, and so on the advice of Chesapeake Wildlife Heritage, Ned Gerber at Chesapeake Wildlife Heritage, you know, we're lucky enough to have in our backyard a not-for-profit organization that builds disappearing habitat. So mm-hmm. we've got lots of fields of houses and that sort of thing, but we're missing mostly grasslands and wetlands. Those are the 2 habitats that we're really missing in the Eastern Shore. So we turned our wet field into a wetland. And so now we have, you know, in addition to the Canada geese and the mallards, which you see a lot of, you know, because there's such high amounts of corn here, we're seeing the birds that have kind of disappeared, you know, like the teal. And then we've got a pond, we've got woodies and black duck again. So and the bird club comes out and counts the bird species. So that's what we did with one of the fields. The first thing we did was put in buffers. We put in 100-foot buffers. And then we figured out, well, what do you do with the inside of the fields? So on the wet field, we put the wetland in. And in the buffers, by the way, the buffers are like warm season grass mixes. So it's like switchgrass, big blue stem, little blue stem, side oats, gamma, a lot of other things I can't remember. But they create, you know, they're perennial, they're deep-rooted, so they absorb, you know, the water and the sediment and the nutrients that would otherwise run off. So now in a rain event, you know, you used to see muddy water just running off the fields into the creek. We're on the Goldsboro Creek, which runs into the Miles River. So now you don't see water leave. It just it stays in because the buffer's really doing a good job absorbing it. But also the buffer creates habitat for, like, the quail. We've lost, like, 85% of our quail in the last 25 years. So we have quail coming back again. And it didn't take very long, like a year or 18 months, you know, after putting in these things, before our farm just started sounding different, looking different, and feeling different. I mean, the you know, nature really wants to heal itself. You give it a little bit of an opportunity, and it really does heal. So that's been really exciting. So then the second field, we put greenhouses up.
That's what we saw coming in.
Yeah, right. And those are just these, you know, high tunnels. They're unheated, and it just extends the season for the crops. It doesn't give you that many degrees differential. It'll give you 30-degree differential in the summer when you don't want it, and only 4 in the winter when you do. You know, nature doesn't like us when we try to trick her. But it does do yeoman's work keeping the really heavy rains off the crop. So, you know, in these times of increasingly odd weather patterns and just torrential rains, the high tunnels really make a difference to protect your crops. So last year, most of my tomatoes outside failed because of the heavy rains last summer, but the ones inside the tunnels were unbelievably, you know, beautiful and productive and pristine. They're also incredibly high productions. You can get 10, 15, depends on what the crop is, 20 times higher yields.
What can you grow in there besides tomatoes? What kinds of things can you grow in there?
Well, right now we've pulled out the tomatoes for the most part, and we're growing greens. We grow carrots. We grow kale, 4 colors of kale, 4 kinds of chard. We grow mizuna. We grow arugula, tatsoi, lettuces, topi amaranth. I mean, nice little salad mix. We make a nice little Cottingham Farm salad mix. And then we have greens, which, you know, they're really hard to come by. You know, you go to a you know, there's some great local restaurants that are featuring local foods and really get that we need to eat more vegetables. But, you know, a lot of restaurants treat vegetables like confetti. It's just this little colorful confetti on your plate. You know, I want to sit down. My husband and I make a pound of arugula every night. You're a pound of kale. We need to eat our vegetables. We need to eat our vegetables. And we grow carrots. We grow really, really sweet, sweet carrots that are like candy.
So now what's the other field? There's a third field.
So then the third field is this, the big one here. And we have just a little teeny field here where we rotate. We're trying to set up a true rotation, which we'll have this year where, you know, land is fallow for 1 year in the rotation. And this field is basically left open. And what we've done is we've put in this space and the other open space is 24 acres of cover crops. The first one failed. We put one in May and it failed. And we've got another one that we've just finished putting in about 10 days ago. And we're hoping we're going to be using that last field as pasture for animals. So I'd like to get into, you know, pastured poultry. Because, you know, most Americans don't, well, I didn't know. Maybe most Americans do know. But, you know, all these things that you're learning, reading things like Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma and The End of Food and Robin's book on food revolution. You know, if you look at a CAFO egg, a confined animal feed operation egg versus a pastured egg, and you ask the average person what's the difference, and they'll say 20 cents, because there's a 20-cent difference. One's affirmatively good for you, and one's affirmatively bad for you. One actually has high levels of the bad cholesterol, which I can never remember, HDL versus LDL, mm-hmm. but the other has high levels of the good cholesterol, low levels of the bad cholesterol, high levels of vitamin D, because the bird's been outside, and tocopherols. And the same thing with meat. If you look at a corn-fed steak versus a grass-fed steak, one has 7 times the levels of saturated fat. Same thing with vegetables. If you eat a vegetable that's had pesticides applied to it, it's got very limited nutrient value because pesticides, I mean, the natural defense of a plant against pests is to produce, one of the defenses is to produce antioxidants. So once humans intervene in the system and spray pesticides, you know, the plant signals stop antioxidant production. So you'll have less antioxidants in a typical vegetable that's been supplied with pesticides, sprayed with pesticides, than one that has not. So there's real differences in our food that the American public really deserves to know about and doesn't.
That was Cleo Braver, owner of Cottingham Farms in Easton. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of On Delmarva. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.